Hello, and welcome to River of Ideas. I'm Nick Bussey, the Communications and Operations Manager here at the MWMO, and today I'm speaking with Jen Ellert. Jen is the Vice President of Metro Bloom's Design Build. She has a bachelor's degree in plant science and sustainable agriculture from Cornell University and a master's of landscape architecture from North Carolina State University. Her work at Metro Bloom's combines her passions for plants and planting design with engaging and educating people about creating resilient and beautiful landscapes. Jen, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a little bit about Metro Bloom's. What is Metro Bloom's?
Yeah, Metro Bloom's actually started early in 1979 as a group of volunteers who were interested in really more beautification and gardening. It was formed by the City of Minneapolis Committee on the Urban Environment and evolved over time into what became Metro Bloom's in about 2008. So Metro Bloom's is a nonprofit organization that was officially started in 2008. And at that time, our focus was more on gardening and beautification. That has definitely evolved over time. So over time, we have really focused our work more on improving water quality, creating pollinator habitat in community. And so that start of Metro Bloom's being rooted in community has really impacted our work moving forward. We now provide educational programming throughout the state of Minnesota regarding cleaning water resources and creating pollinator habitat. That's all given through our educational wing, which is called Blue Thumb. A lot of people have actually heard of Blue Thumb. It's kind of the arm through which our educational programming is provided. We also do a lot of neighborhood projects where we work and partner with watershed districts like MWMO and cities to help residents install rain gardens. We've been doing that. I think our first neighborhood related project started in about 2015. So we've been doing that for quite a while. And now we really want to make sure that we're prioritizing our community work, especially in neighborhoods that have been impacted by environmental injustices. And that can include environmental degradation. And so we really focus on creating community partnerships that are meant and intended to uplift and listen to residents so that we can begin to work together to solve environmental challenges. And that really supports more of our mission-based work, which is to create resilient landscapes and foster clean watersheds, embracing the values of equity and inclusion as we are solving environmental challenges.
Can you tell me a little bit about Metro Bloom's design build and how that's different from sort of the nonprofit arm or related to it?
Yeah, sure. So Metro Bloom's design build was actually established in 2021, and that's who I work for. Metro Bloom's design build houses a lot of our design and construction services. As our nonprofit evolved over time and determined what we really found as a need within our communities, we were providing design services for a long time. But in 2021, we really first started having our own crews to do both land care as well as installation work. And it really made sense at that point to establish the for-profit. We're unique in that the sole owner of Metro Bloom's design build is Metro Bloom's, the nonprofit. And so in that way, it really helps support our mission-based work, so of Metro Bloom's nonprofit. Any additional sort of profit from Metro Bloom's design build can then go to Metro Bloom's to support some of our programming that doesn't have a consistent funding stream. So it's a really nice way in working with people that we can continue to support programs that otherwise don't have a consistent funding stream. And that's usually our educational and equity-based programming.
That's great. So I want to get into a little bit of the subject matter, like what we're talking about when we talk about resilient yards and environmental issues that we can solve through some landscape changes. What kinds of problems do we typically find in urban yards, and how can we make a typical urban yard more environmentally friendly?
Yeah, that's a great question. We really do work in an urban environment. So most of our work at Metro Bloom's is an urban retrofit. So we are working on existing urban sites where we are, you know, trying to improve resiliency on those existing sites. Urban yards certainly have a level of degradation and often a pretty big level of soil compaction. I'd say that's one of the biggest urban challenges to establishing resilient landscapes is just compaction of soils. But they also have a really great opportunity because on a small scale, we can start to develop really resilient spaces that are supporting habitat, that are reducing stormwater runoff. And then if you think about all of those small spaces connected in like our larger city environment, it can have a really big impact. And that's kind of where I feel like our focus lies, is on those specific smaller sites and creating more of a patchwork of native plantings, environmental benefit throughout the city. One thing that's important to think about in urban areas is just how much impervious surface we have. So that really characterizes most of our urban lots, is that they're going to be covered in roofs and buildings and patios. And in that way, there's a lot of opportunity to reduce the amount of runoff that comes off those impervious sites. So we just had a really nice rainfall yesterday. It was great to get some rain. But one of the things that that does is really, if it hits a roof, hopefully it's not soaking into your roof. It's running off. And when it runs off, it's going to go right into the storm drain and then right into the nearest water body. So there's a real opportunity there to create a lot of small rain gardens that are going to capture and infiltrate that runoff so that it's not picking up trash or fertilizer with it and then heading into the storm drain and going downstream. And there's kind of a dual benefit there. When those rain gardens, you can include a lot of native plantings, and those native plants have deep roots, so it's helping that runoff get deeper into the soil. And then the other benefit is that those native plants are providing habitat. So while you're also cleaning water and improving water quality, you can really provide a lot of habitat at the same time. So while I think urban yards have challenges, there's also really a huge opportunity to create really valuable pockets of habitat kind of throughout the city.
So when you're looking at doing a project in a residential yard, how do you start to think about redesigning that landscape? What are some of the different things you think about? I assume you have to think about sort of sunlight versus shade and where the stormwater runoff is going. How do you kind of start to think about a project?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that I think about is really what are listening to, like, the residents, whether that's we work on a couple of different scales. So let me just back up and say that design-wise, we might work with individual residents in their yards. We might work with multifamily residential sites or commercial properties. And the thing we start by doing that is to really listen. So listen to how the residents might utilize the site, what would be important to them, so that our design, while obviously I'm very interested in improving water quality and providing habitat, at the same time, it needs to be really functional. So it needs to be something that the site residents have the ability to maintain or the capacity to maintain, and that needs to function well with the site and its uses as well. Maybe there needs to be a little open space for kids or pets to run around. And that's great. That's really important. And I think in a lot of ways that can foster our connection to the landscape. So what I start by doing is listening, straightforward, just really trying to understand what the stakeholders, whomever they may be, need from the property and how they would use that landscape. Then I take that information and can start to formulate areas where it seems like there's opportunities to make their yards more ecologically resilient. And most people do contact us because that's what they're looking for. So they really are focused on an interest in making their yards more environmentally resilient and providing habitat. So that's usually a priority for them, while at the same time balancing needs of access and open space and things like that. And that listening usually sets up like a framework for how the space can be used. And then I also am looking to see, there are some just sort of general principles of installing rain gardens. We don't, we want to infiltrate as much runoff as possible, but we obviously don't want to impact anybody's personal property and have that, get into a basement. So we need to be very careful about locating those in an area where they can infiltrate runoff safely into the soil. And so it sort of starts by forming that framework, but really we start by listening. And I think it's really fun for me, because one of the things that I enjoy most is helping to design landscapes that are resilient, incorporate a lot of native plants, but that also can fit any aesthetic. And I think that that's a very common way that people think about native plants, is that they must be really wild and messy. I don't think I want a lot of native plants in my yard because I feel like that's going to look really messy. Mm-hmm. And I love that challenge for me, because I feel like there are so many ways to incorporate native plants specifically in landscapes that can be like from a very modern aesthetic to a very naturalistic. And so that's easy to accommodate just in how we pick and design the textures of the plants and the species that we might use. And so that's really a fun challenge for me, is to incorporate that interest in native plants and help those site users create kind of a connection to their landscape through that design, through having it meet their aesthetic and really helping them establish a connection to blooming plants in their yard so that they can kind of begin to be invested in that landscape.
That's great. Tell us a little bit about your personal background. How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, I've always really liked plants. And I started actually with a degree in plant science, and I was headed towards very much a life in agriculture until I realized I was not a very good farmer, and I didn't think that that was going to work for me. We had a family friend who was a landscape designer, and she really encouraged me to look into that field and thought it would be a great fit, and I owe her a lot. It's been fantastic. So I did eventually get a master's degree in landscape architecture from North Carolina State University. And that's been wonderful for me because it really combines both the like design and science of what I enjoyed about the plant sciences, along with designing and really creating landscapes that are utilizing kind of that ecological impact or creating an ecological impact. So for me, the landscape architecture field, which is very broad, and people can do a lot of different things as a landscape architect. For me, that field has been a really wonderful way to combine an interest in design and science at the same time. I'm originally from North Carolina. I am not from Minnesota. And although it is my home state and has been here for a number of years now, and I love it here, North Carolina held kind of a special place for me because I grew up in an area which has like one of the few remaining stands of the longleaf pine tree. So the longleaf pine tree actually used to cover a lot of the southeastern United States, and it was logged for timber and for tar. And so there's very few stands left. It's a really specific ecoregion. And I grew up right in one of the last few stands of that, and it was wonderful. And so it created a real connection to land for me and like a connection to landscapes. And I think that is something that I have been interested in creating through design work, is helping people connect with land and connect with landscapes. And of course, continue like my interest in ecological design and how to promote that.
I wanted to ask about your field, landscape architecture. Mm-hmm. Pretty much all the projects that we work on at MWMO are, you know, native plant focused, stormwater focused, because those are the projects that we fund. Do you feel like there's a trend generally in landscape architecture toward more native plants, sort of ecologically conscious types of, you know, projects?
Yeah, I do. I really do. It's really exciting because this year, this past year in 2023, the American Society of Landscape Architects held their annual conference in Minneapolis. That was a great way for me to reconnect with our field on a personal level. But it was really wonderful to see a lot of the types of projects that were being awarded or highlighted in our field in general. And it was really wonderful to see a focus on ecological design. And I'm seeing that, and we work a lot and hire often students from the University of Minnesota program in landscape architecture. And they really are coming in with a background and understanding and interest in utilizing native plants, in working in a way that promotes ecological design and promotes sustainability. So I'm really encouraged to see how much that is becoming a part of the field. And especially stormwater management. That's a big issue. I'm sure it's obviously a big part of the projects that you all fund because you're interested in reducing stormwater runoff. And so students are coming out with a much better understanding of that.
Tell me a little bit about the Blue Thumb workshops.
Yeah. I mean, Blue Thumb is the time of year when our Blue Thumb workshops are really busy. So it's top of mind for me. So it's good timing. So as I said before, Blue Thumb is really our educational wing, and it is a way that we promote resources about resilient landscaping and things like that. We offer three different workshops. We offer a resilient yards workshop, which is definitely geared more towards a residential do-it-yourselfer. It has like an online module that goes through a lot of detail. We recorded quite a bit of information about how to design and install your own rain garden, how to install turf alternatives, how to reduce turf and put in native plantings, or even just how to care for your yard in a different way. I think it's pretty common for everyone to clean up leaves in the fall, and we have these sort of patterns of the way that we care for our landscapes. So we talk a lot about how to change those patterns to promote pollinators and create more habitat. So that's mostly an online learning module, but then we actually have some virtual and some in-person workshops where folks can meet with a designer like myself for about 20 minutes and get a little bit of individual attention for their specific yard to help answer questions about their own space. So those resilient yard workshops are really great, and they're really kind of all-encompassing. We offer two others. One is a turf alternatives workshop. So there's been a lot of interest recently in how to create more pollinator-friendly lawns and reducing just the use of kind of our classic Kentucky bluegrass and introducing, you know, maybe other grass species like fescue or other pollinator-friendly species into lawns. And so the Turf Alternatives Workshop focuses very specifically on that. And that's really a presentation and a little bit of time for question and answers. And then the last workshop, which has become kind of a greater interest in the past couple of years, is focused on shorelines. So that's where we are presenting information about shoreline restorations, lakescaping, which is really thinking about where your runoff might go if you have a property on a shoreline. We obviously live in an area of a lot of lakes and rivers, and so shorelines are really valuable and really important. It also talks a lot about regulatory requirements. There are quite a few permits that are required for doing some types of work on shorelines that are more specific than they might be if you were just doing landscaping work in your yard without a shoreline. It also talks about those types of restoration efforts, and that's really a presentation and a question and answer session. We're working on a soil health workshop, which we hope to give later this summer and have that be ready. So that's another exciting workshop we're working on. Kind of brings us back to my notes and comment earlier about soil compaction being a challenge for lots of other reasons, but soil health can have a pretty big impact on plant growth. And we're in an urban area where soils have been altered significantly from their original state. And so that kind of helps give some information into how you can increase soil health in your own yard.
So the point about the soil is a good one. And at my last house, we had like sandy loam soils and we could plant like literally anything and it would just take off. The house we live in now has very clay soils and it's a lot of urban fill too. The house was built more recently. And so I was very disappointed when I started digging up the yard and there was broken glass in there and all kinds of stuff that you find in urban yards sometimes. With that kind of theme, what are some common mistakes or maybe things that people need to watch out for when they're thinking about building a rain garden, planting some native plants? What are some things that you look for that might be things you need to address before you maybe do your planting project?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say in cases like yours where there is kind of a heavier clay soil or it's maybe been compacted due to construction, the thing we really recommend is incorporating organic matter into the soil. So that's probably been lost as part of that construction process. And so bringing organic matter back into the soil when you're establishing new plants is really valuable, especially if you have a large area where you're just going to do a bunch of planting. We actually don't recommend that people till their soil with a rototiller. I think that seems intuitive for like preparing a garden bed, but it actually can really sort of pulverize the soil fungi and destroy any existing soil mycorrhizae. So we just recommend that people add compost and maybe use a shovel to turn it in those big chunks. That's better than what would tilling would create much smaller chunks of soil and kind of really pulverize it. So adding organic matter is really helpful, especially when you're establishing new plantings. You know, one of the benefits of native plants is they have really deep roots. And so as they mature and get established, those deep roots will start to help handle some of that soil compaction and break up some of those soils. The other thing that's really important is, especially when you have new plantings, is to use a layer of mulch over bare soil. Bare soil will erode even from a rainfall like the one that we had yesterday, can really help wash away if there's bare soil. So having a layer of mulch is going to hold moisture in, get plants established, and help that organic matter filter into the soil without washing away. So those are just a couple of kind of starting points for establishing new plants. The other thing we really want to bring to everyone's attention when you're establishing new plants is that I think there's kind of a tendency to think that with native plants, you can sort of set it and forget it, right? These are natural. They know what to do. I don't have to do anything. And Native plantings, just like any other landscape, require a certain amount of maintenance, especially when they're getting established. They have baby plants and they might be placed kind of far apart. When that's the case, there's always weeds that are going to come up. We can't help it, but at this point, we have a lot of invasive species in our area. And if you don't do anything, those invasive species will tend to take over. So really, having a plan for maintaining your yard is a great starting point for thinking about establishing new landscapes, whether they be rain garden or a native planting. And that includes pulling those weeds and also, you know, especially because we've had a couple of dry summers, watering new plantings. It's really better to water for longer and less frequently than to water for just 5 minutes every day. If you water for longer and less frequently, it allows that water to get deeper into the soil profile. And then those roots will chase after it. They'll get much deeper and they'll be more resilient to times of drought in future years. So it's kind of like habits that people set up when maintaining their landscapes can have a big impact on how to make them more resilient down the way. I would say the other thing when folks are interested in rain gardens or establishing a rain garden is just to really understand some of the principles of establishing a rain garden. Anytime somebody has a basement, as I mentioned before, you want to stay about 10 feet off of a basement with a rain garden. We don't want to infiltrate any runoff back into, you know, an old basement or old foundation. I live in a really old house, so of course that's something I always think about. And there's a lot of old houses in the Minneapolis area. The other thing to think about is making sure that it's built in such a way that it's actually capturing runoff. So if you really want to put in a rain garden, think about where your runoff is coming from. And I always recommend that people put on a raincoat and go outside when it's raining. And you might be surprised at how much runoff is coming off of your lawn or comes out of that one downspout and then goes right down your front sidewalk into the street and into the storm drain. Yeah. And that's when you see those opportunities to think, oh, okay, that downspout, so there's a lot of runoff coming across my yard there. If I could just intercept that, that would be a great spot for a rain garden. So those are just some initial points to think about when people are thinking about establishing new landscapes or ecologically friendly practices in their yard.
What do you think is like an easy kind of low-hanging fruit type project for somebody who wants to make their yard kind of a more eco-friendly place, either add pollinator habitat or add any kind of habitat?
Yeah. We often get a lot of questions about having a low maintenance landscape, which I certainly understand. We're all busy. We're all working. We have a lot to do. But folks are interested in sort of establishing pollinator habitat, but maybe don't have a ton of time in their yard to do a lot of maintenance. And in that case, I really think focusing on planting pollinator friendly trees and shrubs is a great low hanging fruit. Trees and shrubs tend to be lower maintenance, and they also bloom. A lot of our trees, our native trees, bloom earlier in the spring, so they're really providing pollinator, you know, nectar and forage at a time when there isn't much else that's blooming, and so that's getting ready to happen here in our area. And so those trees and shrubs are really easy to maintain. They don't require as much seasonal care. There's always a saying that said, you know, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. So now is a great time to plant a tree, and not just plant one type of tree, but plant a diversity of trees. Mm. We've obviously been impacted by the emerald ash borer here in our area. And so planting a diversity of tree species is going to help combat any future kind of invasive species that could attack some of our native trees. Mm. And then the other thing about native trees is that since we are in such an urban area, you know, they provide a lot of shade, and so they really can help combat things like the urban heat island effect. They're really cleaning our air. They soak up a lot of stormwater. So trees are just a very easy, beautiful way to start to bring pollinator habitat to your yard.
This brings up something else I've been thinking about, which is we just had, I think, the warmest and driest winter on record. Before we started recording, we were talking about the wildfire smoke that we've been seeing the last few years. And and so you brought up, you know, the point about planting things that are likely to be, you know, resilient as the climate continues to change. With that in mind, what are some things that people should be thinking about right now as we're going into spring? So it's been nice in the last few weeks here. We've actually gotten some precipitation, but it was completely dry all winter. I mean, there was no snow. It was crazy. What are some things people should be thinking about as we go into this spring?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's one we've been getting a lot recently, and also one that we're definitely still learning, also trying to understand both in the short term, so in terms of like just this season, and then if this continues to be a pattern in longer seasons, what kind of impact will that have? I'd say in the short term, the thing people should consider is really kind of putting your hands in the dirt, right? So looking at your plantings, you don't have to start watering right now. And we did just get some precipitation, which is fantastic. But as we start to head into April, and we're really going to start to see a lot of plant growth come up, we've got some warmer temperatures coming in the next week or so. A good thing to do, especially with new plantings that might still be establishing, would be to see if the soil feels really dry. So I think that there will probably be a higher need for supplemental water this year, more so with new plantings than maybe established plantings. But the one thing to think about are some of our trees and shrubs have had a certain level of drought stress for a couple of years now. So kind of occasional deep waterings of trees and shrubs might really help them, you know, get through this period of drought. I obviously don't know and can't predict what future seasons will be like, but that might be helpful, especially with some of those trees that we don't water frequently because they're really, you know, old or established, but might be experiencing a certain level of drought stress. excuse me. The other thing that I think that we're trying to think about is whether or not, you know, the timing of a season like this can really potentially impact pollinators. So, you know, we don't know if trees and species are going to leaf out earlier than when pollinators emerge because of sort of unusual challenges between the warmth of the soil temperature and daylight. So that'll be an interesting observation. And I would just really recommend for everyone to observe what's happening in their yard. You know, do they see pollinators emerge when they see their flowering plants, providing resources so that we can all start to kind of learn what changes might happen if we continue to have warm seasons and warm winters like we did this past winter.
So what are some resources that we could maybe drop a link in the description of the podcast here that people could either learn more about kind of the subject matter in general or some workshops that are coming up or what other resources that they might be interested in?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that probably the best place to go for resources is our Blue Thumb website, and it's bluethumb.org. That's going to have resources that include like plant lists. So especially earlier when I mentioned native flowering trees and shrubs, that's got great plant lists there to make it really easy for anyone who's interested in putting pollinator habitat in their yard. We even have planting templates. So it takes kind of the guesswork out of determining which pollinator species to include in your sunny yard or your shady yard. We've got all of that really easily accessible. So bluethumb.org has a lot of that information available. The other thing that folks can find at Blue Thumb is some information about the Lawns to Legumes program. So if anyone isn't familiar, that's a state-supported program from the Board of Water and Soil Resources that is providing grants to individual residential properties to support reducing turf and adding pollinator habitat to their landscapes, specifically to support the rusty-patched bumblebee, which is our state bee and is an endangered species. But at the same time, since the rusty-patched bumblebee is really a generalist bee species, that habitat goes to support a lot of pollinators within our state. There's a lot of great information on there about how to apply for that grant. And I believe there's another grant deadline coming up in June, if I'm not mistaken. And so that website would have information about how to apply for that grant. So that's a great resource financially as well as, you know, information. And then on our Blue Thumb website, also there's information about the upcoming workshops. So that really has just started. We tend to have a lot of workshops in the spring. Folks are very interested in gardening this time of year. And so we provide those workshops at a timely manner so that as people are getting started in their yards, they can start to think about changing their landscape practices. And so there's some good information there as well.
How about maybe a good place to end is what are some tips, yard care tips that people should be thinking about right now?
Yeah, we really like to get our workshops out and get this information out this time of year. One of the things that I like to tell people, especially in the spring, is to just sort of relax and enjoy the spring. I think there is always an urge to start gardening, start working your landscapes as soon as the snow melts here in Minnesota. We're all kind of ready to be outside. But what that can do is really disrupt pollinators. So they really need time to emerge from the soil. Soil temperatures really need to get to be about 50 degrees before pollinators start to emerge. And one way to tell that soil temperatures are warm enough is if you start to see dandelions blooming in the area. That's a really good indicator that temperatures have warmed to 50 degrees, and it is okay to start cleaning up your yard. It's always a little later than you think that it's time to clean up your yard. You might feel like you're waiting a really long time, but that's a great indicator so that you're not cleaning up your leaves and bagging them up and actually bagging and hauling away moths that might be overwintering in that leaf litter. If you cut back your plants and you cut back all your plant stalks, then any overwintering bees that live in hollow stalks, you might bag them and send them with your yard waste instead of giving them a time to emerge. So, you know, my best advice is to really just take a deep breath, enjoy the spring and go for a hike, and really wait on starting your kind of spring yard cleanup, and don't start it too early. And that's one of the biggest things you can do to support pollinators is just be patient.
Right. Yeah, we always tell that to people too. And right now on our website, we actually have a list of native plant sales, which usually occurs around Mother's Day. And that seems like a good time probably for people to actually start doing that work. So maybe wait until the plant sales and go get whatever you need. And then that's a good time to start your garden cleanup.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You can kind of just use this time right now to plan, to kind of dream, plan, get your plan ready so that when you buy those plants, you know you've got what you want. You go prepare to the plant sale with your list and you can get all the things that you need. You can even use this time to pick a planting template so you have exactly, you know, kind of planned out in your yard where you want that to be. But don't worry so much about cleaning it up or making it look neat and perfect yet because pollinators haven't emerged yet. And so it's still too early to do that. So kind of being patient, right. Do some planning, relax is my best advice for the spring.
That's great. I think that's a great place to end. So Jen, thank you for being here. And we will drop a link in the podcast description here of all the things we talked about. And thank you for listening.